This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. No one had terribly high expectations of Dirty Dancing. When the film debuted 25 years ago, it was largely dismissed as a low-budget love story. Its biggest star, believe it or not, was 51-year-old Jerry Orbach, who was famous mostly for his work on Broadway. And studio execs planned to release it in theaters for one weekend, then send it to home video to suffer the fate of the B-movie. Instead, Dirty Dancing foxtrotted its way into the hearts of audiences, and it became one of the top-grossing films of 1987, earning $170 million worldwide. So here's the plot refresher. Teenager Frances Baby Houseman summers with her family at a Catskills resort in 1963. She meets Johnny, a streetwise dancer hired to entertain the families. Johnny teaches Baby how to move, and along the way, they fall in love, much to the chagrin of Baby's father. Their forbidden romance leads to a climactic dance number, but not before Johnny tells off Baby's family.
Nobody puts Baby in a corner.
Yeah, there you go. This cheesy but complicated story combined with the beautiful choreography, finger-popping soundtrack made Dirty Dancing a big-screen hit and an icon of popular culture. The movie was shot in part in Lake Lure, North Carolina, and that town is now home to an annual Dirty Dancing Festival that kicks off its third year tonight with a free screening of the film. Joining me now by phone from Lake Lure is the co-founder of the festival, Michelle Yelton. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. With me in the studio to talk about the significance of the film Dirty Dancing is Maria Pramaggiore. She is a professor of film studies and associate head of the English department at North Carolina State. Maria, welcome back. Good to have
you
here.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So now this film, I certainly didn't do the film justice. In fact, if you really want the plot summary, you have to talk to Lindsay Foster Thomas, and she will give it to you. And it's better than the film, to be honest. But this is a film. Let's talk about the character of Frances Houseman, who everybody calls Baby. Break that down for us, first of all.
Well, she's actually named after Frances Perkins, who was one of the cabinet secretaries under Roosevelt. And in fact, the writer, Eleanor Bergstein, was named after Eleanor Roosevelt. So you have a potentially feminist heroine here, right? Here's a young girl. She's Jewish. She's planning to go to Mount Holyoke in the fall after this summer that she spends at Kellerman's camp. And she plans to study development economics and go into the Peace Corps. So very socially conscious, bright, intellectual. So a really interesting character in a dance film, right, which we think of as sort of so much about physicality and sex. But of course, this is her coming of age, and this is her coming of age sexually. One of the taglines for the films was, "Dancing sets her free."
And there is this sense of social consciousness. I mean, that she brings everybody up to date when they talk about where people are starving in the world when they're about to waste their food.
Absolutely. And there are some comments. In fact, her sister, Lisa, is complaining about having forgotten to bring her pair of shoes that are coral colored to match a particular dress. And Jerry Orbach, you mentioned, who plays their father, says, you know, this is not a big problem. Police dogs in Birmingham are a big problem. So there are certainly gestures toward the early 60s as a time of social change.
So these themes are certainly present. There are class, socioeconomic classes present in here. Feminism, there is, although the word is never used, there is an abortion that plays a prominent part in this film. So Michelle, now let's take a look at we'll stick with the characters for a moment. Johnny, portrayed, of course, by Patrick Swayze, his sex appeal has probably everything to do with why the film became so popular. Talk about his role and how you think Patrick Swayze captured audiences with that role. Michelle?
I think he really transformed people's minds about a male's role in the dance world. I mean, he was a very masculine guy, and he was the bad boy in the film, yet he was this fantastic dancer. And, of course, he had, in his real life, a long history of dance, and his mom was a famous choreographer. So I know that after reading his book, he really wanted to make that impression on, you know, the pop culture world, that dancing is not just about, you know, ballet. It can be all types of things, but it can also be for a man's man. And he was really impressionable with that. And of course, women were just fascinated by his skill and that he was able to perform so well. And, you know, it didn't hurt that he was absolutely good looking. So yeah, it was just the complete package and really opened a lot of people's eyes to a new dimension of dance especially for guys.
Maria?
I think Michelle is absolutely right there. And while he was interesting in the sense of Patrick Swayze being this object for female desire in the film and for fans, there's also an interesting male fan base for this film. And I think it's because he's that working class, clearly heterosexual dancer. And in fact, there was a stage production premiering in 2004 in Australia, and Eleanor Bergstein was on a call-in show, much like yours there, and a truck driver called in to tell her that he traveled with a DVD player because he watched the film when he stopped at truck stops. And then, according to the report I read, the switchboard or whatever it's called lit up because all of these other truck drivers were calling in to say they really enjoyed the film. So while we think of it as maybe one of the first chick flicks, yeah, it actually has a broader appeal than
but
that.
But what about that character? Let's stick with that for a minute, because I talk about that. I mean, I think about that as the Elvis effect, this kind of liminal behavior where a guy like Elvis and this is – the question really is about the setting. Why is it set in that kind of late 50s, early 60s period? That character gets away with a lot more feminine characteristics. Elvis could swivel his hips. Elvis could have big lips and still appeal to a masculine audience. Patrick Swayze, the same thing. He's doing things that men aren't comfortable doing, dancing, moving their hips like that. But was that only permissible? Is that character only permissible if he looks like a 50s greaser? Can you have that guy anywhere else and still appeal to truck drivers?
I think that's a very good question. I'm not sure. I think the blue-collar, you know, bona fides that he has are really, really important. One reviewer actually said that he suffered from an almost terminal case of working-class inadequacy. So this vulnerability is there as well, and I think you're absolutely pointing out a good question. Can we only see that in terms of what we normally associate stereotypically with working-class men? He's physically strong, he's built, he's tough, and those are the things that have to accompany representations like that, that he's such an object of desire. I mean, there's very interesting subtext in the film about being male gigolos. I mean, Jack Weston, who plays Max Kellerman, the owner of the camp, essentially tells his staff to please the women, right, the daughters of the families who are coming there every summer.
Yeah, well, we have that, too. So Baby, of course, is witnessing some of these class distinctions for the first time. There's the wait staff, college-educated men. They're treated differently from the entertainment staff, who are blue-collar mostly. And then we'll listen to the scene with resort manager Max Kellerman and Johnny.
Well, if it isn't the entertainment staff.
Listen, Wiseass, you got your own rules. Dance with the daughters. Teach them the mambo, the cha-cha. Anything they pay for. But that's it. That's where it ends. No funny business, no conversations, and keep your hands off!
So you think you can keep that straight, Johnny? What you can, can't lay your hands on?
You just put your pickle on everybody's plate, college boy, and leave the hard stuff to me.
Whoa. There we go. A scene from Dirty Dancing. This is one of the things, of course, that critics have also noted, that it's not too subtle when it comes to exposition, but we do now understand there's a class distinction very clearly. So, Michelle, this movie was set in a resort at Lake Lure, and I wonder to what extent, I don't know that the resort itself existed up there, but whether or not these class distinctions were something that was evident in the Lake Lure itself in North Carolina.
Lake Lure is a very tiny, tiny little place, so I don't think that that was necessarily something that was obvious here, because even now today there's only 500 full-time residents. So it was really a very tucked away place that Eleanor Bergstein found and decided that this was the perfect correlation to the Catskills. So,
but it certainly played an important part in the movie, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Pretty much the only class distinction that they had to battle with was the fact that it was the Bible Belt, and here they were trying to do a film that was supposed to be called Dirty Dancing, and instead they went around just calling it Dancing because the town was already on guard for what was going to potentially happen during this film process. So originally, too, they wanted to use our hotel here called the 1927 Lake Lure Inn and Spa as the facade of Kellerman's, but the town voted against them doing that because they were afraid it was too iconic, and should the movie be a bust, they would, you know, have that to deal with. So it was a poor choice on their part. But that was pretty much the culture here then.
That's interesting. So the local folks were betting on and having to think about whether this movie was going to be a success. And there was really, remember, right. Patrick Swayze at this time wasn't Patrick Swayze. I mean, he had not achieved the fame that he had after that movie. So, you know, chances are the movie might not make it.
And Jennifer Grey was the girl from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. She played his sister, and Joel Grey's daughter. It's interesting, as Michelle's pointing out, the choice of location. One of the areas they did try to scout for locations was the Catskills, and there were no longer places that would either allow them to film there during the summer, the ones that were still in business, but much, much fewer by the 80s, really. That whole culture of what's called the Borscht Belt had really died out. There's a wonderful film, by the way, called Welcome to Kutcher's, The Last Catskills Resort, that was just made this year. Carolyn Lastow and Ian Rosenberg, about a resort that had run well into the 2000s. Jerry Seinfeld appeared there, for example, but that culture is no more.
How much do you think this class tension that's certainly evident in the film was important to the viewers, to people to watch that film in 1987? I mean, what I'm wondering is if it was safe to talk about that because it was set in the past, or whether that was a relevant issue still in 1987 when moviegoers went to that film and loved it in the way that they did.
That's an interesting question. What I think the film offered to great extent was a contrast with a lot of the other cinematic offerings of the time. If you think about the 80s, it's generally characterized as, you know, the blockbusters, the Terminator series and so on. You have machine-like, masculine, you know, dominating large-budget spectaculars. And this really presaged the kind of wave of independent filmmaking in the late earlys, in the early 90s. Sundance was just starting. So it is a small film. It is intimate, and the messages of standing up for the little guy, you know, I don't know. We were coming out of the Reagan years. I don't know if that had something to do with it as well, in terms of embracing a nostalgic worldview and embracing a kind of common person ideology.
Well, I would certainly think that the themes, while present, played a lesser role in its success than simply the dynamics and the power of these characters. We get this tension when Johnny, who's the working class dancer, meets a waiter, Robbie, who's a kid from Harvard. He's close to Baby's family. Robbie enters into the picture because of his sexual relationship with Baby's sister, Penny. And so who is also Johnny's dance partner. So Johnny's dance partner, sexual relationship with the Richie Robbie. And here's their encounter.
Oh, God, it's hopeless.
Don't say that. There's got to be a way to work it out.
Baby? Is that your name? Well, you know what, baby? You don't know shit about my problems.
I told her.
Jesus, Billy, now she's going to run and tell her little management boyfriend and we all get fired. Why not skywrite it? Penny got knocked up by Robbie the creep.
Robbie?
Look, baby. One of the counselors knows a doctor. Real MD, just traveling to New Paltz for one day next week. We can get him an appointment, but it costs $250.
But if it's Robbie, there's no problem. I know he has the money. I'm sure if you tell him...
He knows. Go back to your playpen, baby.
There we go. So, again, a fairly deep theme introduced. Just a plot point, or was it meant to be a theme? This is this they're talking about, though they never used the word, an abortion.
Well, and I think it's significant that it's reflecting on an era when you had to, you know, when these were the kinds of places that women ended up. And as Penny in the film ends up with a serious infection and Baby's father has to save her life, I do think that the politics of women's health, as we would describe it now, the politics of abortion, certainly became a very serious issue in the 1980s as conservative and right-wing groups are more and more pushing that at the national level.
Michelle, when you've been running this festival now, this will be the third year at Lake Lure. When people talk about the film, do they talk about what are the topics of conversation? Is it the social issues? Is it the chemistry? What do you hear these days, and how much do you think that's changed from 1987 when the film came out?
I think mostly what people are intrigued by is just the whole love story of the film combined with the dance element. I rarely hear a lot of the social issues. It's more of the pop culture angle where, you know, a lot of people watch this in their youth, and it's one of those movies that people have watched pretty much every stage of their lives. They can still somewhat relate to it, so it kind of becomes a part of them. And they just want to be here where it happened and experience it and feel like they're even more a part of it. So it's definitely an odd dynamic as far as film goes, but these are some diehard fans.
The film is 25 years old. The festival's only 3 years old. How did the festival get started?
Interestingly enough, Lake Lore has never really done anything to commemorate the film or pay tribute to it. So when Patrick Swayze passed away in 2009, we were bombarded with requests as far as, are we going to have a memorial service and what's happening, what's Lake Lore doing? And we were just like, oh, okay, so you want us to do something, okay. So, you know, we held a candlelight vigil in the pouring rain and 750 people came out to it. And wow, that was kind of a sign for us to know that, okay, people really do like this movie. So we decided that maybe we should do something to pay tribute to the film in a major way. And that's how we came up with the idea of the festival. And the first year we held the festival, we had over 2,000 people, and they came from 24 states and two foreign countries. So,
wow, that's pretty.
That was proof enough for us.
Anybody still around who was perhaps had a part in the film?
Yes. In fact, the first year we did some on-air interviews with some of the. There's certainly.
Ooh, sounds like we're breaking up a little bit.
Oh, sorry. There's still some extras that live in Lake Lore that were involved in the movie. And the first year we had a storytellers panel discussion where they shared experiences and what it was like to work on set and work with Patrick and Jennifer. So that was really exciting. And we also did some camera interviews with one of the main Dirty Dancers and also Cousin Brucey Morrow, who was the magician in the movie and is also a legendary 60s DJ. So we got a lot of interesting feedback from them.
Well, Maria, I have to ask you about one great scene in the film, and that is where Robbie, the elite, privileged guy from New England, hands Baby a copy of The Fountainhead and said,
yes,
some people are, you know, more important than others or something like that. It's interesting to me that kind of a greasy, privileged guy from New England who thinks rich people are better than poor people is cast as a villain. Today, you could run for office on that platform.
Absolutely.
Hands her
you
the
got
fountainhead.
That right.
Wow. That's changed a lot, huh?
Absolutely. Well, I think there are a couple of things going on with that fountainhead reference. Of course, Baby rejects it out of hand and pours a pitcher of water into his pants for doing that, even suggesting that. She's so horrified because, of course, she is motivated by altruism. She wants to, you know, help countries develop economically and so on. And that's the opposite of Ayn Rand's philosophy in The Fountainhead. You have Howard Roark, who is the dominant masculine entity. The other interesting element there is this very controversial rape scene in that book, which was controversial at the time it was published and ever since. And there's this suggestion that Robbie is, in fact, that's his view of women. You mentioned he had been having a relationship with Penny, Johnny's dance partner who becomes pregnant. He also is coercing Baby's sister Lisa into a sexual relationship. So his view is made very clear with that reference to The Fountainhead of what he thinks should be the relationships between men and women.
Well, I've got about 10 seconds left, and I have to ask you why a film like this, which is not the deepest film in the world, and yet it has touched so many people. How did it do it?
I would be remiss if I didn't say something about the soundtrack, right? The song for that film, Time of My Life, which is also Patrick Swayze's autobiography title, won every award it was possible to win that year and has lived on and on. So I think the music and the dance, as Michelle points out, we understand these to be ways that we transcend who we are in terms of class and ethnicity and other identities.
I want to thank you both for being on the program, Maria and Michelle. Maria Promajori is a professor of film studies and associate head of the English Department at North Carolina State University. Thank you so much for being here. Michelle Yelton, co-founder of the annual Dirty Dancing Festival, third year Lake Lure, kicks off at 7 o'clock tonight. Free lakeside screening of Dirty Dancing. There's going to be a movie-themed event all day Saturday, some kind or another. For more information, dirtydancingfestival.com. Coming up, the Old Ceremony returns with a new album on the State of Things. Stay tuned.